From Intelligix, this is Intelligix World Religions, an educational look at the world's religions. This show neither endorses nor rejects any belief. Today we are stepping into the world of Sikhism, a faith that emerged in the Punjab region of South Asia about 5.5 centuries ago and has grown into one of the world's major religions, with tens of millions of followers spread across every inhabited continent. By the end of this episode, you will have a clear and grounded understanding of how Sikhism began, who the 10 gurus were, and what they contributed, what the core teachings of the faith actually say, how Sikhs worship and organize community life, and perhaps most fascinatingly, how a sacred scripture came to be regarded not as a book, but as a living guru. There is a great deal to explore, so let us begin at the beginning, in a land where the air was thick with spiritual searching. Picture northern India in the latter half of the 15th century. The Punjab, the land of five rivers, stretching across what is today northwestern India and eastern Pakistan, was a crossroads in every sense of the word. Trade routes ran through it, armies had marched across it for centuries, and spiritually, it was a place of extraordinary meeting and collision. Islam, carried by centuries of Mughal and earlier Sultanate power, had shaped the culture deeply. Hinduism, with its ancient temples, devotional traditions, and complex caste structures, remained the practice of the majority. Sufi mystical orders had introduced their own strand of passionate, inward-facing devotion to the divine. And alongside all of this, a reform movement, known broadly as the Sant tradition, was spreading poetry and song that questioned ritual formalism and caste hierarchy, insisting that God was accessible to every person, regardless of birth or social station. Poets like Kabir and Ravidas were composing verses in vernacular languages that ordinary people could actually understand and feel. This was the world into which Guru Nanak was born in 1469 in the village of Talwandi near present-day Nankana Sahib in Pakistan. Scholars note that much of what we know about Nanak's early life comes from hagiographical accounts called Janam Sakhis, literally birth stories, which were written down well after his death, and blend biography with devotional narrative. Historians approach these texts carefully, treating them as windows into how the tradition understood and revered its founder, rather than as straightforward historical records. What the Janam Sakhis describe, and what Sikh tradition preserves in living memory, is a child who was spiritually precocious, who questioned the priests and scholars around him, who was unimpressed by empty ritual, and who had a profound early experience of the divine. Nanak worked for a time as an administrator for a local official, married, and had 2 sons. And then, according to tradition, something transformative happened. The accounts describe Nanak disappearing for 3 days while bathing in a river. When he returned, he was changed. He is said to have proclaimed, in words that Sikhs consider among his most foundational, "There is no Hindu, there is no Muslim." What scholars debate is the precise meaning and historical context of this statement, but within the tradition it is understood as a declaration that conventional religious labels, the divisions and identities that people clung to, were ultimately beside the point in the face of the one reality that underlies all existence. From that point forward, Nanak began to travel. He undertook journeys. The Janam Sakhis describe 4 great udasis, or travels, across South Asia, into Arabia, Persia, and Tibet, engaging with Hindu priests, Muslim scholars, Sufi saints, yogis, and ordinary working people. He taught through conversation, through debate, and above all through poetry and music. He was accompanied by a Muslim musician named Mardana, and together they would compose and sing hymns, a practice that lies at the very heart of Sikh worship to this day. Nanak eventually settled at a village called Kartarpur, on the banks of the Ravi River, where he established a community. Here, scholars note something historians find genuinely significant. This was not just a gathering of disciples around a wandering holy man. It was a structured community with its own practice of communal labor, communal worship, and, crucially, communal eating. The langar, or free community kitchen, which we will talk about more shortly, appears to trace its roots to these very early days. Before he died, around 1539, Nanak appointed a successor. He did not pass leadership to either of his sons. He chose a devoted follower named Lena, whom he renamed Angad, meaning limb of my own body. This act of choosing a spiritual successor rather than a biological heir established the institution of the guru, the teacher guide, that would define Sikh history for the next two centuries. The word guru is Sanskrit in origin, traditionally understood to mean one who dispels darkness and brings light. In Sikh theology, adherents hold that the guru is not simply a wise human teacher, but a vessel through whom the divine word, called Shabad, flows into the world. This is an important distinction because it shapes how Sikhs understand the relationship between all 10 gurus. The tradition holds that the same divine light, the same spiritual essence, passed from one guru to the next, so that in a deep sense there was one guru manifested in 10 human forms. As one way of expressing this, the 10 gurus all used the same poetic signature in their compositions, Nanak. When you read a hymn attributed to Guru Arjan, for instance, the verse will end with the name Nanak, because Guru Arjan understood himself to be expressing the same continuous light. Let us walk briefly through the 10 gurus and what each one contributed, because each life adds a layer to the tradition's development that is essential to understanding modern Sikhism. Guru Angad Dev, the second guru, is credited with formalizing the Gurmukhi script, the alphabet in which Punjabi is written and in which the Guru Granth Sahib is composed. This was a consequential act. By standardizing a script, Angad helped to ensure that Nanak's compositions and teachings could be preserved and transmitted in a consistent form, accessible to ordinary Punjabi speakers rather than only to those educated in Sanskrit or Persian. Guru Amar Das, the third guru, deepened the egalitarian dimensions of Nanak's teaching. He instituted the requirement that anyone who wished to meet him, including emperors and nobles, must first eat in the langar alongside everyone else, regardless of caste or status. He also organized the growing Sikh community into administrative districts and established special gatherings at festival times that brought Sikhs together from across the region. He appointed women as leaders of these local congregations, a detail scholars note as remarkable given the social norms of the time. He also composed a beautiful and extensive hymn called the Anand Sahib, the Song of Bliss, which remains central to Sikh liturgical practice. Guru Ram Das, the fourth guru, founded the city of Amritsar, which would become the spiritual and cultural capital of the Sikh world. His name means servant of God, and he composed what is known as the Lavan, four verses that form the basis of the Sikh wedding ceremony, the Anand Karaj, which adherents understand as a spiritual as well as a social union. Guru Arjan Dev, the fifth guru, accomplished something extraordinary. He compiled the first official scripture of the Sikh faith, a text known as the Adi Granth, the first book, or original book, completed in 1604. This was not a collection of Guru Nanak's writings alone. Guru Arjan gathered compositions from his four predecessor gurus, added a substantial body of his own poetry, in a move that speaks directly to the universalist strand in Sikh teaching, included hymns from non-Sikh saints and poets. Kabir, Ravidas, Namdev, Farid, and others found a home in this scripture alongside the Sikh guru's compositions. The finished text was installed in the newly constructed Harmandir Sahib, the temple at Amritsar, later known to the world as the Golden Temple, and a Sikh scholar was appointed to read from it continuously. The Guru Granth Sahib, as this scripture was ultimately named, is organized not by author or chronology, but by musical measure, by raga, reflecting the primacy of devotional music in Sikh worship. Guru Arjan's own contribution to the text includes the Sukhmani Sahib, a long and beloved hymn whose name means peace of mind, as well as hundreds of other verses. Guru Arjan was executed in 1606 by the Mughal Emperor Jahangir, becoming the first Sikh martyr, a pivotal moment whose significance for the community can hardly be overstated. Guru Hargobind, the sixth guru and son of Guru Arjan, responded to his father's martyrdom by introducing what the tradition describes as the concept of Miri Piri, the two swords of temporal and spiritual authority. He wore two swords, one representing each dimension. This did not mean Sikhism abandoned its spiritual center, adherents emphasize. Rather, it meant that the community recognized it could not be indifferent to worldly justice and protection. Guru Hargobind built the Akal Takht, the throne of the Timeless One, directly across from the Harmandir Sahib in Amritsar. The Akaltakht remains the seat of Sikh temporal authority to this day. Guru Har Rai, the seventh guru, and Guru Har Krishan, the eighth guru who died as a child of smallpox while tending to sick people during an epidemic, are revered figures whose lives embody qualities of compassion and service that the tradition holds dear. Guru Tegh Bahadur, the ninth guru, was executed in Delhi in 1675 by the Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb. According to the tradition, he gave his life defending the right of Kashmiri Hindus to practice their own faith freely, even though he did not share that faith. Sikhs understand this as an act of profound principle, a martyrdom on behalf of religious freedom itself. He is remembered as Hindi Chadar, the shield of India. His compositions, added to the scripture, include hymns of profound contemplative depth. And then there is Guru Gobind Singh, the 10th and last human guru. His life transformed the outward face of the Sikh community in ways that are still immediately visible today. In 1699, on the festival of Vaisakhi, he gathered a large assembly of Sikhs at Anandpur Sahib and founded the Khalsa, the community of initiated Sikhs committed to a distinctive code of conduct and identity. The founding of the Khalsa is one of the most dramatic episodes in Sikh history. As tradition tells it, Guru Gobind Singh called for volunteers willing to give their lives for the faith, and five men stepped forward one by one. These five, known as the Panj Pyare, the five beloved ones, became the first members of the Khalsa. The Guru baptized them with a ceremony using sweetened water stirred with a double-edged sword, a ceremony called Amrit Sanchar, or the Khande di Pahul, and then, in a gesture Sikhs find deeply moving, he asked the five to administer the same initiation to him, the Guru himself, dissolving the distinction between teacher and disciple. The Khalsa was given a shared code of identity, including the wearing of five articles known as the five Ks, or Panj Kakars: Kesh, uncut hair as a sign of accepting God's will and natural form; Kanga, a wooden comb representing cleanliness and order; Kara, a steel bracelet symbolizing the eternal cycle and the bond with the Guru; Kachera, a specific style of undergarment representing self-discipline; and Kirpan, a small sword representing the commitment to defend truth and protect the vulnerable. Male members of the Khalsa took the surname Singh, meaning lion. Female members took the surname Kaur, meaning princess or lioness. These names were themselves egalitarian in intent, cutting across caste surnames that had perpetuated hierarchy for generations. Guru Gobind Singh also made a decision that changed the structure of Sikhism permanently. He declared that after him, there would be no 11th human guru. The line of living human gurus was complete. Instead, he vested the authority of the guru in two things: the scripture, the Guru Granth Sahib, and the Sangat, the Sikh community gathered together. Wherever five Sikhs gather in accordance with Sikh principles, goes the teaching, there I am present. The Guru Granth Sahib was thus declared the eternal living guru of the Sikhs. This is not metaphor for adherence, it is a literal theological reality. The scripture does not merely contain the teachings of the gurus, it is the guru, present and accessible to every Sikh who comes before it. Let us now turn to the heart of what Sikhism actually teaches, because the beliefs are as remarkable as the history. At the very beginning of the Guru Granth Sahib, before any of the hymns, stands a brief composition that Sikhs call the Mool Mantar, the root or seed mantra. It is widely considered the foundational creed of Sikh theology, and it begins with two characters that are among the most recognizable symbols in the Sikh world: Ik Onkar. Ik means one. Onkar is a rendering of the sacred syllable Om, associated across South Asian traditions with the primal sound of existence. Together, Ik Onkar, one God, one creator, one being, encapsulates what adherents hold to be the central truth of Sikh spirituality, the absolute, indivisible oneness of the divine. The Mool Mantar continues: Satnam, whose name is truth; Karta Purakh, the creator being; Nirbah, without fear; Nirvar, without enmity or hatred; Akal Murath, undying beyond time; Ajuni, unborn, not incarnated; Saibang, self-illumined; Gur Prasad, known through the grace of the Guru. Then the single word, Jap, contemplate. Each phrase of the Mool Mantar unfolds a dimension of what adherents understand as the nature of the divine. God in Sikh theology is not a figure with a body, not a deity who takes human or animal form, not limited by any created category. God is formless, Nirankar. God is everywhere, Sarvyapak. God is the one force, presence, and truth underlying all that exists. There is no Satan, no principle of evil in opposition to God. Creation itself is understood as an expression of divine will and presence, though the tradition is careful to say that creation is not identical with the Creator. Human beings, in Sikh theology, are understood to be separated from this divine reality by a condition called haumai, ego, or self-centeredness. Haumai is not quite the same as the Western concept of sin, though scholars note it functions in a somewhat analogous way. It is the illusion of the self as separate from God, the error of placing one's own ego, status, desires, and identity at the center of one's existence. The five thieves, kam, lust, krod, anger, lub, greed, moh, attachment, and ahankar, pride or ego, are the manifestations of haumai that lead a person deeper into spiritual confusion, which the tradition calls maya, the illusory pull of the material world. The path out of this condition is not severe asceticism, not withdrawal from the world, not elaborate ritual. The Sikh tradition is emphatic on this point. Guru Nanak explicitly criticized Hindu ascetics who abandoned their families and social responsibilities, just as he criticized Muslim clerics who performed prayers mechanically without inner transformation. The path is Nam Simran, the remembrance and contemplation of God's name. This is understood not merely as repeating a word, but as a deep, continuous awareness of the divine presence woven through every moment of life. It involves Gurbani, the recitation and singing of the Guru's sacred poetry, and it is cultivated through Sangat, the company of fellow seekers who support and inspire one another. The Sikh teaching on how a person achieves spiritual liberation describes a progression through five realms or stages, the khans, outlined by Guru Nanak in his composition, the Japji Sahib, which opens the Guru Granth Sahib. These stages move from the realm of Dharma, righteous action, through knowledge, spiritual exertion, grace, and ultimately to the realm of truth, Sach Khand, where the soul merges with the divine. The ultimate aim, adherents hold, is mukti, liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth, achieved not through withdrawal, but through living a fully engaged life in the world while remaining spiritually aware. This brings us to one of the most distinctive and beloved aspects of Sikh teaching, seva. Seva means selfless service, service rendered without expectation of reward, recognition, or benefit to oneself. For Sikhs, seva is not merely a nice ethical practice. It is understood as a form of worship, a direct expression of the recognition that God is present in every person. When you serve another human being, you are serving God. When you labor in the langar kitchen, chopping vegetables and serving meals to strangers, you are engaging in an act as spiritually significant as any meditation or prayer. The langar, the free community kitchen that feeds anyone who comes to a gurdwara, Sikh temple, regardless of religion, caste, gender, or background, is perhaps the most visible institutional expression of seva and of Sikh egalitarianism in the world today. Every major gurdwara in the world maintains a langar, and some of the largest, like the kitchens at the Harmandir Sahib in Amritsar, serve hundreds of thousands of meals daily. During times of natural disaster and crisis, Sikh communities worldwide have organized langar operations to feed affected people. The practice is so deeply embedded in Sikh identity that it has been described by adherents not as charity, which carries connotations of superiority, but as a recognition of shared humanity. Alongside seva, Sikh ethical teaching emphasizes kirat karo, earning one's living through honest labor, and van chako, sharing what one earns with others. These three principles, nam japna, remembering God, kirat karo, honest work, and van chako, sharing with others, are sometimes described as the three pillars of Sikh practical life. The Sikh understanding of caste is an important area to address, because it is both a central teaching and a site of ongoing lived complexity. Guru Nanak was explicit and forceful in rejecting the caste hierarchy that governed so much of South Asian social life. His composition in the Guru Granth Sahib and his actions, eating with people across caste lines, appointing disciples regardless of birth, were a direct challenge to the caste system. Subsequent gurus deepened this commitment. The langar, where everyone sits together on the floor in rows and eats the same food, was designed precisely to enact equality across caste boundaries. Scholars of Sikhism note, however, that like many religious communities committed to egalitarian ideals, Sikh communities have at times struggled to fully realize this ideal in practice. Caste identities have persisted in some Sikh communities, and scholars and Sikh reformers have documented cases where caste distinctions have influenced marriage practices and social life. Sikh theologians and community leaders are, by and large, consistent in affirming that such practices are contrary to Sikh teaching, and the conversation about how to more fully live the Guru's teaching on equality remains an active and sometimes passionate one within the community. Now let us spend a moment with the Guru Granth Sahib itself, because it is one of the most remarkable sacred texts in any religious tradition, and understanding it is essential to understanding Sikhism. The scripture in its final form, as it exists today, is the product of two compilations. Guru Arjan compiled the first version, the Adi Granth, in 1604, as we noted. After Guru Gobind Singh's time, his own compositions and the compositions of Guru Tegh Bahadur were added, and the text was finalized and installed as the Living Guru. Scholars note that the final recension of the text is associated with the Damdami Bur, a version standardized at Damdama Sahib, though debates about the precise textual history continue in academic circles. The Guru Granth Sahib contains 1,430 pages. Every printed copy is exactly 1,430 pages, because standardization of pagination has been enforced since the early 20th century. It contains compositions in multiple languages, Punjabi, Braj Bhasha, Sanskrit, Persian, Sindhi, and others. A linguistic breadth that reflects both the scholarly range of the gurus and the inclusive spirit of the text. The non-Sikh saints represented include Muslim Sufi poets and Hindu Bhakti poets from various caste backgrounds, including Ravidas, who came from a caste traditionally considered untouchable. Their inclusion is understood by adherents as a direct expression of the teaching that spiritual wisdom is not the property of any one tradition or social group. The organization of the Guru Granth Sahib by raga, by musical mode, is not a superficial arrangement. In the Sikh worldview, music is not an embellishment of worship, it is a vehicle of the divine. Kirtan, the devotional singing of Gurbani, the sacred compositions, is the central act of Sikh congregational worship. Shabads, the hymns in the Guru Granth Sahib, are meant to be sung according to the raga assigned to them, because the emotional and spiritual texture of each raga is understood to carry the meaning of the words deeper into the consciousness of the listener and singer. How is the Guru Granth Sahib treated physically? The answer tells us a great deal about how Sikhs understand its status. In a Gurdwara, the Guru Granth Sahib is installed on a raised platform called a takht under a canopy. It rests on cushions and is covered with elaborate cloths called rumala when not being read. A person called the Granthi, a reader and caretaker of the scripture, is responsible for its care and reads from it during services. The Granthi waves a ceremonial whisk called a chauri over the scripture, a gesture historically associated with royalty and now understood as a sign of the scripture's sovereign status. The Guru Granth Sahib is opened ceremonially at the beginning of the day and closed ceremonially at night in a ritual called the Sukhasan. When a Guru Granth Sahib is moved, it is treated with the reverence due to a living dignitary, carried on the head, with the congregation standing. There is a practice called Akhand Path, the continuous, uninterrupted reading of the entire Guru Granth Sahib from beginning to end, which takes approximately 48 hours. Teams of readers take turns so that the reading never stops. This is performed on special occasions like weddings, funerals, and festivals. A shorter version, the Saptahik Path, takes place over 7 days. The principal Sikh worship service is called Diwan. It takes place in the Darbar Hall of the Gurdwara, where the Guru Granth Sahib is present. The congregation sits on the floor. Men and women may sit separately or together, depending on the community, removes shoes at the entrance, and covers their heads as a sign of respect. There is no ordained priesthood in Sikhism in the hierarchical sense. Any Sikh who has learned to read Gurbani can lead services. The service centers on kirtan, congregational singing of hymns, along with katha, the explanation and exposition of scripture. The service ends with the recitation of Ardas, a communal prayer that remembers the sacrifices of Sikh history and petitions for blessings, and with the distribution of Kara Prasad, a warm, sweet pudding made of flour, butter, and sugar, prepared in equal portions and distributed to everyone present without distinction. Then everyone is invited to the langar. Within Sikhism, there is meaningful diversity that observers sometimes underestimate. The Khalsa, those who have undergone the Amrit Sanchar initiation and observe the full code of conduct, including the 5Ks, represent one important strand of Sikh identity. But many Sikhs, sometimes called Sahajdari Sikhs, have not undergone this initiation and may observe the practices and teachings of the faith without taking every aspect of the Khalsa code. The relationship between Khalsa identity and Sikh identity more broadly has been the subject of theological and sometimes legal debate, particularly in diasporic communities where issues of institutional representation have arisen. There are also distinct historical communities within Sikhism. The Udasis are an ascetic order traditionally traced to Sri Chand, one of Guru Nanak's sons, though mainstream Sikh theology does not grant them guru status. The Nirankaris and Namdaris are movements that emerged in the 19th century with their own distinct emphases and, in some cases, claims about the continuation of the guruship, claims that have placed them outside the bounds of mainstream Sikh tradition. Scholars note that the Namdari movement, in particular, developed a significant following and a distinctive identity, and the question of who properly belongs within the fold of Sikhism, and on what basis, is one that Sikh scholars and institutions continue to navigate. The Shiromani Gurdwara Parbandak Committee, known as the SGPC, was established in 1925 and serves as a major institutional authority governing historic gurdwaras in Punjab, Haryana, and Himachal Pradesh. The Akal Takht, as mentioned, remains the seat of Sikh temporal authority, and its Jathadar, head, is empowered to issue hukamnamas, authoritative directives to the Sikh community on matters of conduct and doctrine. How much authority these institutions have and how they exercise it is a matter of ongoing discussion, particularly among diaspora Sikh communities who sometimes have different perspectives on certain social and political issues than Sikhs in Punjab. Sikhism in the contemporary world faces a range of challenges and questions that the community engages with actively. The Punjab, spiritual homeland of the Sikh faith, was divided by the partition of British India in 1947, a catastrophe for the Sikh community, which found itself at the fault line between India and Pakistan. Millions of Sikhs were displaced, and countless lives were lost in the violence that accompanied partition. The loss of Nankana Sahib, the birthplace of Guru Nanak, to Pakistan, and the separation of many historic Sikh sites from the main body of the community in India created wounds that are still felt. The events of 1984, including the Indian Army's Operation Blue Star at the Harmandir Sahib in June, and the anti-Sikh violence that followed the assassination of Prime Minister Indira Gandhi in November, are among the most painful chapters in the modern history of the community, and they continue to shape Sikh identity and political consciousness in profound ways. The question of how these events should be characterized, remembered, and addressed is a deeply important one within the community and between the community and the Indian government. Sikh communities in the diaspora, in the United Kingdom, Canada, the United States, Australia, and elsewhere, have built thriving institutions and have made significant contributions to their adopted societies. They have also faced distinctive challenges, including experiences of discrimination and hate crimes, particularly in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, when Sikh men wearing turbans were tragically misidentified by some as associated with extremist movements. The Sikh community's response, which included public education efforts, interfaith dialogue, and consistent advocacy for civil rights, is noted by many observers as a remarkable demonstration of the community's commitment to its values of dignity, service, and engagement. Questions about gender within Sikhism are another area of lively discussion. Sikh teaching is clear in affirming the spiritual equality of women and men. Guru Nanak's compositions include explicit statements to this effect, and the tradition has historically had women in leadership roles. At the same time, scholars and Sikh women's organizations note that in practice, women's participation in certain ceremonial roles has sometimes been limited or contested, and that gendered social norms from the broader South Asian cultural context have at times persisted within Sikh communities. The question of whether women should be permitted to perform certain roles at the Harmandir Sahib, for instance, has been a point of public debate. The role of the Sikh scripture in all of these discussions is central, because the Guru Granth Sahib is understood as the living guru, the ultimate authority. Appeals to its teachings play a key role in community discernment on contested questions. One of the characteristics scholars find most interesting about Sikhism is precisely this. The community is asked to return again and again to the sacred text, not as a historical document, but as a present, speaking guru. The practice of Hukam Nama, the random opening of the Guru Granth Sahib each morning to receive the day's teaching, embodies this sense that the scripture speaks freshly, continuously, to the living community. This is not bibliomancy in the casual sense. It is understood as an act of communion with the Guru's living presence, and the verse obtained is read, explained, and taken as guidance for the day. Scholars who study Sikhism draw on a wide range of methodological approaches. Historians work with colonial-era archives, including Mughal court records, early European traveler accounts, and the records of the British East India Company and later the British Raj, whose policies profoundly shaped the institutionalization of Sikhism in the 19th and 20th centuries. Scholars in the field of textual studies analyze the Guru Granth Sahib as a literary and religious document, examining its language, its intertextual relationships with other South Asian devotional literatures, its musical dimensions, and the history of its transmission and standardization. Scholars of religious practice study Sikh ritual, including the debates within the community about what constitutes authentic or orthodox practice, debates that intensified in the late 19th century during the Singh Sabha reform movement, which sought to define and purify Sikh identity in the context of colonial modernity and competing influences. Ethnographers have produced rich studies of Sikh community life in Punjab, in the diaspora, and at pilgrimage sites. And scholars of theology and philosophy engage with Sikh thought in conversation with broader comparative discussions about theism, mysticism, ethics, and community. One methodological note that scholars of Sikhism frequently emphasize: the tradition is one that is still sometimes treated as a kind of hybrid or offshoot of Hinduism or Islam, rather than as a distinct and independent religious tradition. Most scholars in the field today are emphatic that this framing misrepresents Sikhism. While Guru Nanak and subsequent gurus engaged deeply with both Hindu and Islamic thought and drew on elements of both, the tradition they developed has its own distinctive theology, its own scripture, its own ritual practices, its own community institutions, and its own self-understanding as a unique path to the divine. Treating it as a synthesis of its neighbors, scholars argue, fails to take the tradition seriously on its own terms. One thing that strikes many who encounter Sikh thought for the first time is a quality that is perhaps best described as an insistence on the experiential over the merely formal. Guru Nanak's critique was not aimed at any one religion in particular. It was aimed at the gap between outer religious performance and inner transformation, wherever that gap appeared. A Muslim who recited prayers mechanically and a Hindu who performed rituals without inner devotion were, in his view, missing the point in similar ways. What the tradition calls for, again and again, is Satcha Vyavar, living truthfully, and Prem, love, as the quality of the soul's relationship to the divine and to other human beings. The Guru Granth Sahib contains a verse attributed to Guru Nanak that is among the most frequently cited in the tradition. Nanak, the name is a jewel. To obtain it is the purpose of human life. Its brilliance illumines the within. Its luster is the Guru's grace. This captures something essential about what Sikh spirituality seeks, not a set of external achievements or ritual performances, but an internal illumination, a quality of awareness and love that transforms how a person moves through the world and how they treat every person they encounter. For those encountering Sikhism for the first time, there is something worth sitting with after this episode. Here is a tradition that, in the midst of intense religious conflict and social hierarchy, insisted that God belonged to no religion, that no person was spiritually superior to any other by birth, and that the truest form of worship was to see the divine in every human face and to serve accordingly. Here is a tradition that enthroned not a living priest or a monarch, but a book of poetry and music, as its eternal guide. Here is a tradition whose most sacred site has a door on every side, open to every direction, welcoming all who come. The Harmandir Sahib, the Golden Temple, has four entrances, one facing each of the cardinal directions. The symbolism is one that adherents themselves emphasize. All people, from all directions, are welcome. That is perhaps as good a place as any to end an introduction to this remarkable faith. Sikhism continues to develop, as all living traditions do. Its community navigates the tensions between preserving what is essential and adapting to new circumstances. Its scholars and practitioners debate what the guru's teachings mean in a changing world. Its diaspora communities carry the tradition into new cultural contexts and ask what it means to be Sikh in Canada, in England, in the United States, in Singapore. And through all of it, in gurdwaras on every continent, the voice of the Guru Granth Sahib rises in devotional song in the early morning hours, the chori moves gently over the open pages, and the community gathers to listen, to serve, and to share. Thank you for spending this time with us on Intelligix World Religions. We hope this introduction has given you a richer sense of Sikhism's depth, beauty, and continuing vitality. If this topic interests you further, we encourage you to seek out academic works by scholars such as Nikki Guninder Kaur Singh, W.H. MacLeod, Gurinder Singh Mann, and Pasha Ora Singh, who have written extensively and thoughtfully on Sikh history, theology, and community life. Visit a gurdwara if you have the opportunity, most welcome visitors, and experience for yourself the hospitality and warmth of the Langar. From Intelligix, this has been Intelligix World Religions. We will see you on the next episode.